Welcome. This is Cheryl at the Talking Information Center. Thanks so much for joining me. Today is Thursday, April 9th, 2026. I'm reading from the Providence Journal. The first article is entitled, Filling the Gap, AI Supplements World War II Documentaries. World War II documentary filmmaker Tim Gray has found artificial intelligence useful for filling gaps in his stories. World War II was the most photographed and filmed war in history, according to Gray. But the cameras weren't there, or the film didn't survive. Every important historic event, especially some of the most heinous. Gray's 44 films are woven together with historic film clips and photographs, as well as more recent interviews with participants and experts. But AI recreations have been sprinkled into about six of the latest films to help to tell the stories. Recreating World War II history, one scene at a time. World War II history, one scene at a time. It's a way to create things that don't exist visually, said Gray. It's a great tool because it fills in the storytelling gaps. Gray, who was president and founder of World War II Foundation in Wakefield, started using AI about 4 years ago. For us, we looked at it as something that could supplement the work that we were doing with our documentary films in terms of creating video and images that didn't exist from the war, he said. His foundation also runs the International Museum of World War II in Wakefield. More inside, how Rhode Island courts are using facial recognition to track people. For example, he said, in making a final landing on Iwo Jima, Gray and director of photography, Jim Kopacek, were hamstrung because there are no images of the Japanese soldiers who were dug into the vast network of caves on the island. AI solved that problem. You can tell AI what you're looking for. You know, we're looking for Japanese soldiers in a cave on Iwo Jima, and they'll create something for you, he said, and then you have to tweak it. For example, the rifles and helmets might not look authentic, so the filmmaker might have to direct AI to include a specific type of rifle or a Japanese helmet. You do that until you get it the way you want. Still, images of Japanese soldiers in the caves were blended in with the other elements to produce the documentary. The filmmakers also used an AI-produced image of a burning village in making Village of Death, Orador Sur Glane, 1944, where the Germans SS slaughtered 643 civilians, according to Gray. There is no film that exists of that massacre, so you do the best you can using photos that exist after the massacre and photos that exist before the massacre, said Gray. But there are no photos of the massacre and women and children being put into a church that's burned, so how do you tell that story? AI has given us another tool that allows us to do just that. Does AI replace people? In the past, said Gray, he might have hired reenactors to recreate scenes, but AI can do it faster and for less money. Kopacek, who's been making documentaries with Gray since 2006, is pleased he can use AI as an additional tool, but considers it a last resort. He said it's not something we do for fun. It's easy to get started with an image from AI, but producing a historically authentic image can be difficult, even impossible. For example, in making the film about Orador, he and Gray needed an image of an MG-42, German machine gun. They worked with AI, but AI couldn't get it right, so they scrapped it from the documentary. It wasn't perfect. Are there ethical considerations when using AI to create images in a documentary? When he uses AI in a documentary, Gray makes sure the viewer knows. Ethically, we have to let the viewer know this is recreated. So we always put AI recreation on anything that's created, because that's the ethical way to do it when you're doing a documentary. You don't want to try and pass something off that's false as real. Gray worries about the proliferation of AI-created work on the internet that doesn't indicate it was produced by AI. He says some people have used it for nefarious purposes, showing people saying something they didn't say or looking a certain way. He likened it to the Nazis' use of propaganda to turn Germany against Jewish people. You can't regulate the internet, so people are at the point now where they don't know what's real and what's fake, is what he said. A chance at justice for abuse survivors. Rhode Island House votes to allow victims to sue the diocese. For the second year in a row, the House has approved a bill to allow victims of sexual abuse by clergy to sue the Roman Catholic Diocese of Providence and any other entity that knew but failed to stop or concealed the abuse they suffered as children. The legislation would also provide the victims with a 2-year window to revive claims currently barred by expired time limits. The vote was 67-5 along party lines. After one lawmaker after another expressed their disgust at the decades of abuse of children by trusted clergy, who, in the words of Representative Teresa Tanzi, had been told were their normal mortal connection to God. The legislation sponsored by Representatives Carol McEntee reflects one of several legislative actions that Attorney General Peter Nerona recommended in his scathing report on the sexual molestation of more than 300 Rhode Island children by at least 75 Catholic clergymen and the culture of secrecy that surrounded these crimes. Read it, McEntee told colleagues. This report documents decades of child sexual abuse within the Catholic Church. Concluded the church leaders systematically protected accused priests and prioritized the institution's reputation over the safety and protection of children. They failed to report abuse to the authorities. They failed to properly investigate, and they shuffled abusive priests around to unknowing and unsuspecting parishes where they would once more abuse the children. The report makes it clear that these actions of church leaders was knowing and intentional. It's yet another example of people in powerful places abusing children for their own gratification and failing to own it. Please send a message today that we value our children over the institutions that enable these pedophiles. Give the survivors a chance at justice, she said. The Rhode Island House approved the same bill last year on a 67-5 party line vote, but it died for lack of action by the Senate amid stated concerns about the legality of allowing civil suits now to recover damages for long ago crimes against children. McEntee, the House Judiciary Chair, reintroduced the bill this year. The Rhode Island House approved the same bill on a 67-5 party line. Her sister, Ann Webb, 73, was among the first to go public with what her family's parish priest did to her over a 7-year period that began when she was in kindergarten at the Sacred Heart Elementary School in West Warwick. But there were many others. According to a footnote in Nerona's report, the advocacy group Child USA has reported that Arkansas, California, Delaware, Hawaii, Louisiana, New Jersey, New York, Guam, Maryland, the Northern Mariana Islands, and Vermont have temporarily or permanently provided revival windows. The diocese has again this year led the opposition, warning of bankruptcies that similar legislation precipitated in dioceses in other states. Republican Representative Brian Newberry, a lawyer, raised the only objections to the bill during the brief House debate. "I'm not here to defend the Catholic Church or any other particular institution. I'm here to defend due process of law," he said. "Statutes of limitations exist because it becomes almost impossible to defend yourself against decades-old claims. These cases are not going to go to trial. Maybe one will, but the vast bulk of them will be settled and there will be costs extracted that are not going to be limited to the Catholic Church," he said, noting that a similarly broad law in Maryland opened the door for alleged survivors to pursue decades-old claims involving state-run juvenile facilities, public schools, foster care systems, and other government agencies. The Reverend Bernard Healy raised similar arguments in written testimony to a House committee. "Statutes of limitations promote fairness and closure by preventing stale claims in which evidence is lost, memories change, and witnesses disappear. How did we get here? In 2019, state lawmakers passed legislation to give the victims of sexual abuse more time to sue the priest, teachers, coaches, and others who molested them when they were children. The new law gave them 35 years to sue after reaching adulthood, which means age 53. The new 35-year time limit only applied to civil suits against perpetrators, meaning those who committed the actual abuse against institutions. The new 35-year rule was prospective only in most cases. In 2023, the Rhode Island Supreme Court ruled that the 2019 law that extended time limits for filing suit against priests who molested children did not also change the time limits for filing suits against church higher-ups who supervised the offending priest. The ruling upheld the decision of Superior Court Judge Nettie Vogel, who in dismissing three lawsuits acknowledged that the allegations the men made against the abusive priest were hideous and appalling, and said their lawsuits against the diocese leaders set out a most compelling series of acts and omissions that defy explanation. But she said the 2019 law did not allow retroactive suits against institutions if the deadline had already run out under the old law. What would the proposed new law do? The legislation, H-7200, co-sponsored by House Speaker K. Joseph Shirachi, very specifically allows what the 2019 law did not. Lawsuits for a limited period of time against those whose negligent conduct caused or contributed to the childhood sexual abuse by another person. The wrongful conduct would include negligence or default in supervision, hiring, employment, training, monitoring, failure to report, and or the concealment of sexual abuse of a child. The deadline for filing these look-back lawsuits would be June 30, 2028. This was Senate President Valerie Lawson's response a week ago when asked the prospects for passage of the revival bill this year. Quote, "Attorney General Nerona's report documents the extensive, horrifying abuse that took place across Rhode Island and the repeated failures of the church to protect innocent children. The voices of all abused victims are foremost in the minds as we consider these bills," said Lawson. Other bills headed for votes. Two other bills that Nerona recommended were approved. One would extend the statute of limitations on second-degree child sex abuse from 3 to 10 years from the date of the offense, or 10 years from the victim's 18th birthday. in second-degree sexual assault cases. Typically, there's no sexual penetration, but something else the Attorney General's investigation documented. Touching, fondling the genitals of a person, including over their clothes. A third approved bill would extend the state's mandatory reporting of abuse and neglect requirement to charter schools, parochial schools, after-school programs, camps, and various other programs involving children. Brown parts ways with embattled police chief. Amid reports that a legal settlement has ended Rodney Chapman's five-year tenure as Brown University's police chief, the institution announced Wednesday, April 8th, that a former Providence police chief has taken over Chapman's previous role. Brown has appointed Hugh T. Clements, Jr., who served in an interim capacity as the university's public safety leader following the December 13th mass shooting at the university, to the title of police chief and vice president for public safety emergency management. Clements will report to Brown's executive VP for finance and administration, Sarah Latham, and provide dotted line reporting to the university's president, Christina H. Paxson, while serving on the president's cabinet, which underscores Brown's commitment to clear accountability, leadership continuity, and a sustained focus on campus safety at a time when safety is a critical part of healing and recovery for the community, according to the news release. The Brown Daily Herald reported that Chapman's employment with Brown ended through a legal settlement in the Workers' Compensation Court. Chief Judge Robert Ferreri announced on April 7th. The news release from Brown confirms his April 7th departure. Chapman's leadership was under fire long before the December 13th mass shooting brought scrutiny to the level of security on the campus, and Chapman was put on administrative leave. In August 2025, all 10 Brown police sergeants voted no confidence in Chapman. In October, Brown's 40-member patrol association also approved a non-confidence vote, citing various issues, including a toxic work environment. Chapman filed a claim in Workers' Compensation Court in late March, asserting he had suffered an employment-related injury. Ferreri denied the petition. On April 7th, he approved a settlement agreement reached between Brown and Chapman. Who is Hugh T. Clements, Jr.? Clements' career in public safety launched in 1985 when he first put on a Providence police uniform and worked the night patrol shift. Over the next 17 years, he rose through the ranks and contributed to many significant investigations. Clements later served as a deputy chief, acting chief. He became the department's chief in 2012 and embraced strategies that involved working closely with communities to address violent crime. A data consumer, he showed an ability to accurately recite statistics on shootings and homicides from memory. In 2023, Clements took on a new role in the federal government, directing the U.S. Department of Justice's COPS office. The office advances community policy programs through grant funding and technical assistance to help local, state, tribal, and territorial law enforcement. As part of that role, he became a high-profile law enforcement leader at the national level, testifying before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, making appearances at many police conferences across the country. Clements also directed a critical incident review of the mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. Today in history. Today is Thursday, April 9th, the 99th day of 2026. There are 266 days left in the year. On this date in 1682, explorer and fur trader René Robert Cavalier reached the Gulf of Mexico, which was renamed by the American government as the Gulf of America in 2025 via the Mississippi River. He claimed the basin area for France and gave it the name La Louisiane. 1784, King George III ratified the Treaty of Paris, effectively and officially recognizing the end of the American Revolutionary War. It was previously ratified by the newly formed U.S. Congress on January 14, 1784. 1860, Edouard Leon Scott de Martinville made the first known recording of a human voice on the phonograph machine he invented. 1865, Confederate General Robert Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant at the Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, signifying the end of the Civil War. 1866, the Civil Rights Act of 1866 was enacted after Congress twice overrode President Andrew Johnson's veto. It was the first federal law to define citizenship and provide civil protections to all citizens, including black citizens. 1881, outlaw William Billy the Kid Bonney was found guilty of murdering the sheriff of Lincoln County, New Mexico. Sentenced to hang, he escaped jail 19 days later. 1939, African American international singer Marian Anderson performed a concert at the Lincoln Memorial to a crowd of 75,000. Initially set to sing at Constitution Hall, she was denied entry because of her skin color by the Daughters of the American Revolution, who owned the venue. 1947, a group of black and white activists embarked on bus rides to the South from Washington, D.C., on the Journey of Reconciliation. Known as the first of interracial freedom ride, it was a test of then-recent Supreme Court decision to strike down segregation on interstate travel. The journey lasted 2 weeks. The group faced multiple instances of harassment, with some of the activists being arrested. 1959, NASA announced the selection of the United States' first seven astronauts, dubbed the Mercury Seven. Out of 110 candidates, the seven chosen were Scott Carpenter, Gordon Cooper, John Glenn, Gus Grissom, Wally Schirra, Alan Shepard, and Deke Slayton. In national news, maker of tumblers prevails in suit. A federal judge dismissed a proposed class action lawsuit accusing the maker of Stanley tumblers of concealing that the popular water bottles contained lead. In a decision on April 3rd, U.S. District Judge Tanya Lynn in Seattle said consumers did not demonstrate a specific and plausible risk of harm from lead by using the tumblers, which are made by the defendant Pacific Market International. The colorful tumblers are sometimes known as Stanley Cups and became popular, particularly among women. Lawyers for the plaintiffs did not immediately respond to requests for comment. A lawyer for the defendant had no immediate comment. Litigation over the tumblers began after reports of possible lead contamination went viral on social media in early 2024. Pacific Market International, based in Seattle, said it used pellets to help keep tumblers' contents at proper temperatures, and that while the pellets contained some lead, it was inaccessible to consumers once sealed. The plaintiff said they would not have bought Stanley Cups or would have paid less had they known the risk. Lynn said the plaintiffs did not show the use of lead in Stanley tumblers would be material to reasonable consumers. She also found no showing that the mere presence of lead was dangerous or that the pellets could contaminate the contents of the Stanley tumblers, be ingested, or be inhaled. Rhode Island courts are using facial recognition to track people. Rhode Island's court system has been using AI-assisted facial recognition tools to track and monitor court visitors who may become a security issue, but free speech advocates worry about how the data is being used. Concerns about courthouse and judicial security led to the courts adopting the FaceMe software program starting in 2024, with facial recognition cameras at court entrances and exits, according to Lexi Chris, spokesperson for the Rhode Island Judiciary. The technology identifies and tracks certain monitored individuals within the courthouse. Here's what to know about it. The courts piloted the facial recognition program at a cost of $2,940 a year through CyberLink Corp. CyberLink is a Taiwan-based company that bills itself as the world's leader in multimedia software and AI facial recognition technology. The company developed and owns over 200 patented technologies, including FaceMe. The facial recognition software can be used with the judiciary's video surveillance system to verify the identity of an individual from a digital, photographic, or a video image. How are the photos and videos of people used? During the pilot, the judiciary tested the system, developed a policy regarding the use of facial recognition technology at its facilities. According to the policy, the court's security system includes video surveillance, facial recognition technology, while preserving the privacy and constitutional rights of all individuals in judicial buildings, including the Judicial Records Center in Pawtucket. Well, that ends our segment for today. Thanks again for joining me, and I wish you a wonderful week ahead.